This show is part of One Place, a daily network of focused briefings across the stories people follow most.
Welcome to our daily roundup. We are diving into a series of intense stories today, ranging from public safety crises in Texas to significant legal developments in high-profile murder cases across the nation.
Three suspects are in custody after 12 Austin shootings.
A Georgia man was sentenced for shooting his girlfriend.
An Army veteran faces charges for threatening President Trump.
A Florida daycare worker admitted to abusing an infant.
A Texas man killed his girlfriend, then bought beer.
Khoury Richens showed strange behavior during her murder sentencing.
States are considering firing squads for future death penalties.
A Nebraska town remains shaken by a brutal murder.
Starting in Austin, Austin is reeling after a terrifying series of at least 12 shooting incidents that began on a Saturday afternoon. Police Chief Lisa Davis reported that the chaos started with a stolen vehicle and a stolen firearm, though investigators didn't initially realize the events were connected. Over the next 24 hours, the suspects went on a rampage, primarily targeting South and East Austin. They didn't just fire at random people, they actually targeted two different fire stations. In one chilling instance, a fire truck was struck by gunfire while firefighters were standing right behind it. The violence also extended to apartment buildings, forcing officers to go door-to-door to ensure residents were safe. It was a senseless, high-speed wave of violence that left four people wounded, including one person who is currently in very serious condition.
The details of the arrests are just as dramatic as the shootings themselves. After a massive search involving multiple agencies, Manor Police and the Travis County Sheriff's Office spotted a white Kia that matched the description of one of the suspect vehicles. When they attempted a traffic stop, three suspects jumped out and tried to flee on foot. Two teenagers were quickly apprehended, and a third suspect was detained shortly after. Chief Davis highlighted how random and cruel these attacks were, mentioning a poll camera that captured the suspects shooting a woman through their car window while she was simply standing and talking to someone. Mayor Kirk Watson expressed the city's collective shock, noting that there seems to be no clear motive for such a senseless spree that disrupted so many lives across the entire city.
Now to Georgia. In a truly horrifying case out of Georgia, 27-year-old Donald Wooten has been sentenced to 60 years in prison. He was convicted of attempted murder and criminal attempt to commit feticide after shooting his pregnant girlfriend in the head. The motive, according to prosecutors, and Wooten's own statements to detectives, was that he simply did not want to be a father and was angry that his girlfriend chose to continue the pregnancy. The victim was found by EMTs in a fetal position near a walking trail in Decatur, awake but unable to communicate. She had suffered a gunshot wound to the back of her head and was 22 weeks pregnant at the time. It is a miracle she survived, but the trauma of the event left her in a coma with no initial memory of the attack.
The medical team had to perform an emergency C-section to save the baby while the mother was still recovering from her life-threatening injuries. During the investigation, Wooten tried to provide a false alibi, claiming he was with someone who later told police they didn't even know him. However, investigators used a receipt found in the victim's car and digital location data to prove he was at the scene of the crime. The DeKalb County District Attorney's Office emphasized that the defendant's specific intent was to kill the unborn child by targeting the mother. While the victim eventually woke up from her coma, she initially had no idea what had happened to her. This sentence ensures that Wooten will spend the next six decades behind bars for an act of violence that nearly destroyed two lives.
Next up, federal prosecutors have unsealed a criminal complaint against Daniel Swain, a 41-year-old U.S. Army veteran who allegedly planned to assassinate President Donald Trump. Swain was caught in North Carolina while driving a black BMW X5 that was covered in threatening messages written in white lettering. Some of the messages included phrases like, "Hated to WSH to kill the press," and "Tell Donald he is fired." He even wrote the term "double tap" on his window, which refers to firing two shots to ensure a target is dead. The investigation began after an employee at a car wash noticed the threats and called 911. When police searched his vehicle, they found a drone, which prosecutors suggest could have been used for surveillance or planning the attack. It is a chilling reminder of the persistent threats against high-level officials.
Swain's history suggests this wasn't his first attempt to reach the Capitol with ill intent. He admitted to investigators that he had traveled to Washington, D.C. during the winters of 2025 and 2026 to take action against the president, though he later tried to claim he only meant legal protesting. He told agents he had previously wussed out of carrying out his plans. Beyond the physical evidence on his car, Swain allegedly posted violent threats online, stating he wanted to put a round in the president's head. While he was initially picked up on minor charges during a traffic stop, the federal government has now stepped in with much more serious charges related to the direct threats against the president's life. He remains in custody as the legal process moves forward in the Eastern District of North Carolina.
Moving to Florida, a daycare worker in Panama City, Florida, is facing severe charges after a 3-month-old boy in her care suffered devastating injuries. 26-year-old LaKayla Hamilton has been charged with 2 counts of aggravated child abuse. The infant was found to have skull fractures, broken ribs, and a broken leg, along with extensive bruising. Initially, Hamilton tried to claim she had no idea how the injuries happened, then changed her story to say she tripped over a toy and dropped him. However, when detectives pointed out that the injuries were far too severe for a simple fall, she allegedly confessed to a much more violent reality. She told investigators she was in a bad mood due to personal issues and a text message she received that morning. She described her reaction as spazzing out and taking her rage out on the defenseless infant.
The details of the confession are heartbreaking. Hamilton used a doll to show police how she repeatedly slammed the baby into his crib and a changing table, estimating she did this between 5 and 10 times for each. She also admitted to hitting the boy in the head with toys because he wouldn't stop crying. She told police she was so enraged that she couldn't even provide specific details about every strike. Medical professionals noted that the boy likely would have died if his mother hadn't noticed something was wrong and sought immediate medical attention. Fortunately, the infant is now in stable condition, but the severity of the abuse has shocked the local community. The Quality Learning Child Care Center is now under intense scrutiny as the legal case against Hamilton proceeds through the Florida court system.
In Texas, a 49-year-old man named Juan Manuel Yanez has been sentenced to life in prison for the cold-blooded murder of his girlfriend, Victoria Valadez. The crime took place in San Marcos, Texas, where Yanez shot Valadez in the head while she was sleeping. What makes this case particularly disturbing is Yanez's behavior immediately following the shooting. Surveillance footage from a nearby 7-Eleven showed him buying 4 beers just 20 minutes before he called 911 to report the crime. He actually drove the victim's own truck to the store, then returned to the apartment to make the call. When police arrived, the beers were still cold on the scene. There were no signs of a struggle, confirming the theory that she was killed in her sleep. It was a calculated and heartless act that left the victim's family and the community in total shock.
After calling the police, Yanez didn't wait around. He fled to Houston, which is over 150 miles away, where he lived with a completely different family. Along the way, he ditched the murder weapon and removed the SIM card from his phone to avoid being tracked by GPS. Despite these efforts to disappear, law enforcement tracked him down and arrested him near his Houston home after a brief manhunt. Prosecutors were never able to establish a clear motive for why he chose to end Valadez's life, but the evidence was overwhelming. He had her blood on his clothes and jewelry, and he had left his wallet on her nightstand. Yanez pleaded guilty to murder earlier this month, and while he is eligible for parole in 30 years, the life sentence reflects the gravity of his actions.
Now to Utah. The sentencing of Kuri Richens for the murder of her husband, Eric, was filled with bizarre and emotional moments. Richens was sentenced to life in prison without parole after being convicted of lacing her husband's cocktail with a lethal dose of fentanyl. The hearing took place on what would have been Eric's 44th birthday, a timing the judge refused to delay despite defense objections. Throughout the proceedings, Kuri's behavior was described as visceral and often inappropriate. She was seen making faces of disgust and surprise while Eric's sisters gave their victim impact statements. She frequently mouthed the word, "What?" and whispered intensely with her legal team. This lack of traditional remorse or even a neutral expression stood in stark contrast to the gravity of the life sentence being handed down by Judge Richard Mrazek in the Park City courtroom.
Perhaps the most gut-wrenching part of the sentencing involved the couple's 3 young children. Statements from the boys, all under the age of 14, were read in court. They described feeling scared and uncomfortable around their mother after their father's death. with one son even mentioning that she would leave them in the basement while she spent time with a neighbor. The children explicitly asked the judge to ensure their mother never left prison. Kuri's demeanor only seemed to soften when her own family members spoke on her behalf, showing a sharp shift from the faces she made during the prosecution's presentation. Ultimately, the jury's conviction on charges of murder, attempted murder, and insurance fraud led to the harshest possible penalty, ensuring she will spend the rest of her life behind bars for the calculated poisoning of her husband.
Regarding executions, the United States is seeing a surprising return to a very old method of execution, the firing squad. As states struggle to obtain the drugs necessary for lethal injections, the Justice Department has encouraged federal officials to consider this visceral alternative. South Carolina has already utilized firing squads recently, and Idaho is currently renovating its execution chamber to accommodate the method. While it sounds brutal, some experts argue it might actually be more reliable than lethal injection. Dr. James Williams, a firearms expert, explains that the near-instant loss of blood pressure from a firing squad leads to a rapid loss of consciousness. This stands in contrast to botched lethal injections, where autopsies have suggested prisoners may have felt like they were drowning while appearing paralyzed and peaceful on the outside. It is a grim debate about minimizing suffering in a system that is inherently violent.
This shift back to firing squads effectively strips away the medical theater that has surrounded the death penalty for decades. By using syringes and barbiturates, the system attempted to make executions look like a clinical procedure, but the reality has often been much more complicated and prone to error. Public support for capital punishment has been declining, dropping from 80% in the mid-90s to just over half of Americans today. High-profile botched executions have played a major role in this shift in public opinion. As more states authorize firing squads, the conversation is moving toward whether a more honest and visceral method is preferable to a failing medicalized one. It highlights the ongoing struggle within the legal system to find a way to carry out the ultimate penalty that meets constitutional standards against cruel and unusual punishment.
Finally, in Nebraska, the small town of Colon, Nebraska, with a population of just over 100 people, was forever changed by the brutal murder of Sharon Erickson. Erickson was a beloved retired county treasurer who was known for her high standards and friendly demeanor. Her body was discovered in her garage after she missed her daily routine of visiting the post office and bank. Initially, investigators thought it might have been a suicide because a gun was found near her head, but they quickly realized that was impossible since there was no magazine in the firearm. The discovery of her phone line being cut and an alarm going off further pointed toward a violent struggle. This case, which is now being profiled on Oxygen's The Killer Among Us, shows how a single act of violence can destroy the trust in a tight-knit community, where everyone thought they knew their neighbors.
The aftermath of the murder was characterized by intense suspicion and finger-pointing. In a town so small, the idea that a killer could be walking among them turned friends into suspects. Residents who once looked out for each other began looking at one another with fear and doubt. Erickson's friend, Don Clark, recalled how people started accusing each other almost immediately. The investigation revealed that Erickson was in her pajamas when she was killed, suggesting she may have been targeted in the early morning or late evening. While the case has seen various developments over the years, the psychological impact on the town of Colon remains a central part of the story. It serves as a haunting example of how a quiet, rural life can be shattered by a crime that leaves a community searching for answers and safety for decades.
That wraps up our briefing for today. Thank you for joining us for these important updates. We will be back tomorrow with more of the stories that matter most to you.